Today on the Errata Movie Podcast, we're talking about a bunch of new movies that are in theaters now or will soon be on DVD, including The Savages, starring Laura Linney and Philip Seymour Hoffman, and I'm Not There, the Todd Haynes film about Bob Dylan.
You know, does this balloon take action and have preferences? It seems to. But you see, that's unrealistic.
And I love that character. And if he plays that character for the next 10 years, that'd be okay by me. You know, that'll be just fine. And so
now maybe that's the filmmaker's fault. Make a better movie. Make a movie people do want to see.
This is Robert Davis. You may have noticed that some movies seem to hang around forever, especially around Oscar season. Well, that's good for us. We have been really behind lately, and there are a few movies that are still in theaters that we meant to talk about long ago, and we're going to talk about a couple of them today. Some of them may actually have moved on to DVD, but that's okay. They still exist. You can still watch them. They may not have come to your town anyway. So we have three miniature discussions slash reviews of movies like that at the top of the podcast. And then we're going to do the speed round. And the speed round is what you do when you're really behind. And the way it works is like this. You take some speckled birds and then you do some film criticism fast. That's called the speed round. Well, that's not the entire recipe. I don't want to be like MacGyver. You know, where they leave out one important step so you don't blow yourself up. We're all adults here. I'll give you the full recipe. What you do is take some Dexedrine, speckled birds, West Coast turnarounds. Take those and you put them into a cup. On top of that, you pour a can of Red Bull. You drink this concoction with a straw. And I'm not talking about a fat straw like you get with bubble tea. I'm talking about one of those thin cocktail straws like you'd stir your coffee with at Starbucks. Drink that down. Now you've got some wet pills. You can discard those. Not necessary. In fact, if you prefer, you could use a fistful of pennies. Same effect. Red Bull, straw. This is the way it was explained to me by J. Robert Parks. Or it may have... was it J. Robert? It may have been Richard Roper or Keith Richards. I think it was an interview I read, actually. Keith Richards. Anyway, that's how it works, and that's what we'll do to breeze through a bunch of movies. I think you're going to enjoy it. I don't really care if you do. I take that back. I do care. And there's actually something I've been meaning to tell you, and that is, I don't know how personal to get here, but you, I'll just say it, you're our favorite listener. I don't know. You know, it's something about the way you listen or the way you sort of pause and unpause the podcast from time to time. I don't know. But you should call more often. You know, we'd like to hear from you sometime. We'll give the number at the end. Also at the end, we'll reveal which of the movies we talk about today is the fake one, the one that doesn't exist. So, stay tuned.
John, it's me.
Dad is losing his mind or something. I got a phone call. There's something wrong with him. This is a crisis.
I don't think this actually qualifies as a crisis. It's an alarm.
You mean it's like we're in orange?
Exactly, but we're in yellow, okay? So we should just be aware and be cautious. When it hits red, then we're in trouble.
That's a little bit from the trailer for The Savages. And here to kick off the discussion of that film is J. Robert Parks. J. Robert, what'd you think?
Well, I saw this. It was the closing night of the Chicago Film Festival, and the Chicago Film Festival runs the first couple weeks of October. But the movie itself, I thought, had real qualities to it that I thought were worthwhile, even though I'm not necessarily a huge fan. I think Philip Seymour Hoffman is fantastic. Maybe I should back up. Yeah, the movie is about Philip Seymour Hoffman and Laura Linney, our brother and sister, in middle age. And their father is, his health is deteriorating. And his ability to care for himself is completely gone. And so they need to move him from his home in Arizona to a nursing home. And so they move him from Arizona to Buffalo, which is where Philip Seymour Hoffman's character lives. And neither Hoffman nor Linney have had a good relationship with their father. That's pretty clear from early in the movie. But they both feel at least some amount of guilt about putting him in a nursing home. And so the movie is about their relationship. It's about dealing with their past relationship with their father and where the, what's happening to him now. And so in that sense, it was I like the story because it feels contemporary. And maybe it's because I turned 40 this summer and my parents are fortunately all in good health. But it, you know, in the back of my mind, I'm thinking that could be me in 10 years or 15 years. And what would I do?
As one of the kids, you mean? Not
exactly. Yes, yes. Yes. Hopefully, hopefully, no one will be putting me in a home anytime soon.
Yeah.
But it. And so, in that sense, the movie rings true, and that's aided, I think, in great part by Philip Seymour Hoffman's performance and Laura Linney, who's also quite strong. And so, I liked the acting a lot.
I liked their relationship more than I liked sort of the view of dealing with an elderly parent. I felt like that was almost sort of simplistic, especially as compared to like Sarah Polley's movie Away From Her, which is exactly this, but you know, it involves a old age and a home and things like that. So there's some similarities, but it's a much wiser movie. But I agree with you that their relationship was interesting. One thing you didn't mention is that Laura Linney is a playwright and Philip Seymour Hoffman is, I'm not sure if he's writing plays, but he has a PhD in drama and he teaches drama and he has a particular interest in Bertolt Brecht and he's working on a book about Bertolt Brecht. And they almost have this, these dual approaches to their lives as drama people. I'm not saying this very well. She has a much more sort of emotional engagement with what's going on, and he's a very sort of cynical and callous look. The home doesn't matter; they're all just where people go to die. You know, is sort of his attitude, and I think it's this distance that he appreciates in Brecht. You know, that you don't get too emotionally involved in the art you're looking at. That she embraces, so it's sort of an interesting parallel there, or not parallel, but yin yang, I guess.
Did you find yourself sympathizing more with one of the two characters than the other?
I think probably Hoffman more than Linney, and I think it may have to do with that. I think he fits a sort of pattern that these types of movies sometimes have, so I was expecting that he would be a cold person who would warm by the end. And so sort of wanting that to happen and wanting the movie to end, actually, I felt like it was long and I was losing patience with it after a certain point. So yeah, I would say him probably more. How about you?
The same. And I wasn't sure if that was because I just liked his performance more or because I am also maybe a little bit distant sometimes. Or maybe a little bit colder. I wasn't sure, but I found myself very much in tune with his character and not quite as in tune with Laura Linney's character, even though she clearly is the focus of the film. You know, it's very much, I think, it's directed by Tamara Jenkins, a female director, and it has a very distinctly female point of view, which is refreshing. We so rarely get that in movies, particularly Hollywood movies. But yet I found myself more interested in Hoffman's character, which I thought was interesting.
Well, I think he's presented as authentic and she is not quite so authentic. In fact, there are little hints about her being inauthentic.
Yep. I think I like the film a little bit more than you do, although I am not necessarily ready to recommend it wholeheartedly by any means. But there were things that I did like about it.
I think what I didn't like about it is sort of summed up in this one thing that happens. The people who work in this home where they've placed their father mention something that happens to a resident's toes before they die. And I felt like this is, first of all, ridiculous. Maybe it's true. I don't know if it's true or not, but the way it's presented is hokey. And whenever it was presented, it was as if it's set up as a warning, as if, you know, watch for DEFCON to go to 5 and then, you know, we're really in trouble. Or, you know, if the tornado ever gets a rating of 5, then we're in big trouble. Or if, you know, this person's toes go under, watch out. And so not only was I like, oh, come on, now we have to wait for that to happen. but it's taking forever to get there. I kept thinking, yeah, when are we, you know, I thought we were close to the end, and now I know we have to wait for the toes. So, so I don't know. That was the sort of frustration I had with the movie, that I felt like it was real on one level and yet as hokey as could be on another. And I had very little patience with that side of it.
Yeah, I can appreciate that. You know, I have my similar reaction involves the nursing home workers. And one of the things that I like about the movie is it really gives a lot of dignity to those workers and treats, even though they have difficult and not terribly glamorous jobs, they're still treated as people worthy of respect, and they're not just these faceless characters. And so I like that part. But then once we actually get to know one of them, then he becomes the all-wise, all-loving, you know, all-perfect, you know, I think he's from Jamaica even, you know, Jamaican worker. And it just felt like that was not real. That was just merely a Hollywood cliche that we've seen trotted out way too many times before.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's interesting how the same movie can have these, you know, nice moments to them and then kind of these clunky moments as well.
Yeah. Now, one other thing I'd like to say about this movie is that you and I often get to see movies without knowing very much about them, you know, get to go in cold. I say get to because I like that a lot. I love to, you know, go into a movie. I especially love to go into a great movie knowing nothing about it and come out just thinking, wow. So yeah. I went in knowing nothing about this movie. And expectations can have a lot to do with how you see a movie, as we've talked about a lot. And so I went to see what the trailer looks like, and I was surprised to see that this movie is really being marketed as a comedy. Oh. Descriptions of it are that it's a hilarious comedy with that also has a heart. And I think it has some, you know, funny small moments, but I would not consider this a comedy in any way.
Oh. And particularly once you get out of Arizona, you know, the first 20, 25 minutes of the movie take place mostly in Arizona. And there are some funny moments there.
It's sort of David Lynch light. Yeah, a little bit.
But once you move to Buffalo, it's pretty pretty bleak. Intentionally so. But yeah, I had the same experience. I went and looked at the trailer and was kind of shocked.
Yeah.
It's like, oh, there are going to be some people who are going to be disappointed at this if this is what they're expecting.
Yeah, and that's not a knock of the movie. That's of the marketing. So.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely.
Well, I'm curious to hear what you think of the new Todd Haynes film, I'm Not There, which is another new movie that's going to be in theaters soon.
It's about Bob Dylan. It's gotten a lot of notoriety for having, is it 5 or 6 different people who are playing the Dylan character?
Yeah, several, 5 or 6.
Several. No, but not, it's not just 5 or 6 different people who look like Dylan. We have a young African-American boy plays him at one point in time. Cate Blanchett plays him for a good part of the film. Christian Bale's there. Heath Ledger is there. A couple of other people whose names I can't recall.
Richard Gere,
that's right. So we have, that's right. So we have a whole series of quite different people who are playing Bob Dylan. And so clearly what Haynes is doing is talking about, you know, the different personas that Dylan has had over his career. You know, from the early protest folky guy to, you know, we have glimpses of his Christian phase and you know, the electric phase after the Newport Film Folk Festival. And so, and he's trying to capture that by having, you know, a variety of different actors and very different actors. And so for me, I think that's interesting. But I'll be honest, I found myself getting a bit bored. And I can talk more about why, but what was your experience with the film?
Yeah, I feel the same way. I think it is an inspired approach to the biopic. I'm not somebody who loves biopics. I mean, Walk the Line I thought was enjoyable. But in general, the whole idea of compressing somebody's life into an hour and a half, and then not only that, but finding, you know, the one important thing and sort of making it the central part of their life, you know, it's always just so reductive to reduce somebody to that.
And it's also always cliched.
Yeah.
I mean, it's amazing how most biopics, the structure of the film is the same. no matter who the person is.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, oh, everybody. I mean, to the point where it becomes a little bit like a Love Boat episode that you can almost predict, you know, okay, oh, that's, we've reached this point in the film, so now the next thing has to happen.
If you can survive the near-fatal car crash, then you are destined for greatness. Yeah. Yeah, it's VH1 Behind the Music.
Exactly.
But
I mean, I'm sorry, go ahead.
I was just going to say, but this is not that at all. This is I think this is an inspired way to look at someone who's had multiple images, personalities, you know, throughout his career. He's had such a long career, and he's even someone who's changed his name. You know, his name isn't really Bob Dylan, and so he's always sort of been creating these personae, and this sort of riffs on that, and I think that's a really cool idea. I don't think it's completely all together. I think that's a great idea that doesn't bring out a lot of new insights about Bob Dylan. I think that was maybe my biggest disappointment. I do think, though, it probably helps to, it seemed to me that it helps to know a lot about Bob Dylan's biography, which I don't. I know certain areas, and I know certain songs and certain song lyrics, and I could see them alluded to in the parts that I was familiar with, but then the other parts I wasn't. You know, maybe those would have seemed better to me if I were more familiar with that part of his life, for example. Right. But there were a lot of interesting things. Like there are points when two different of these characters will sort of meet very briefly in a dream or in some sort of a strange sequence that we don't really understand if it's a dream or not. And that's neat because I guess it implies that Dylan was reflective on these different you know, images he had, but it doesn't, it's so brief and such a flash that it doesn't, I don't think, go down that route either.
Yeah, I completely agree. It, for me, there were interesting things about it that have nothing to do with the film. The last couple of weeks in one of my classes that I teach, we've been talking about postmodern culture, and you know, I'm Not There could be exhibit A for postmodern film. You know, it's this, you know, dealing with ideas of fragmented identities. It's playing with ideas of form. I mean, we have black and white sequences in this film. We have color sequences in this film. And I'll be honest, I don't quite know why we have sometimes black and white and why we have color. You get the sense that Haynes is just having fun sometimes with different formal elements that he can use. But
well, I think he's also kind of put each character into its own movie style, or even its own movie. Like the Cate Blanchett sequence, much of it resembles Fellini's 8½.
Yeah.
Or the Richard Gere stuff, which is the loner outlaw Bob Dylan, who's later in life. It sort of resembles McCabe and Mrs. Miller, Robert Altman's Western, that's sort of quiet and distant. So that's part of the rationale there, I think. But I agree with you. It feels like a big pile of stuff.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and so in that sense, there's not an attempt to make any sort of unified whole or even make any sort of point. But it does become progressively less interesting for me. You know, I knew about a halfway in, it's like, well, at some point we're going to get to his Christian phase, and that will probably end the film. And so I just started kind of waiting for that to happen. You know, I love Dylan's music, and so there's great pleasures in that. And any movie that sort of lets you listen to Visions of Joanna for the whole, you know, 3 minutes of the song gets great, great props from me. But
yeah, Haynes had access to the actual recordings and the music to use how he wanted, which was pretty unusual. Mm-hmm. And it's neat. I like that too.
Yeah, it's but still it. I was thinking about this. Well, let me ask you, since you said you're not as familiar with Dylan's history, were you still able to keep up with it all? I did sort of understand what the heck was going on.
Yeah, I actually do sort of know the summary of Bob Dylan's life, and I have Blood on the Tracks in my in my record collection and things like that.
Yeah.
So I'm probably more familiar maybe than the average moviegoer maybe, and yet there were lots of parts where I felt like, I bet this is referring to something and I just don't know what it is.
See, that for me was one of the things that I was thinking about afterwards, was that I don't know if anyone under the age of 30, unless they really know a lot about music history, will be able to make any sense of this at all. You know, because the movie is trading on these iconic ideas that we have of Bob Dylan. And so there are these sort of allusions and references at various points, you know, you know, a couple different times you see references to motorcycles early in the film. Well, you know, if you don't know that Bob Dylan had a motorcycle accident in the mid-60s that kind of creates this break in his career, what does that mean to you? You know, it's just sort of a random image.
Yeah. But I think that's a conscious decision that Haynes made just to decide, you know what, I'm riffing on the biography as I know it, and, you know, up to you to keep it up.
Absolutely. But then the question becomes, what's the point of the film? Because if you're making a film for really only people who know that iconography. Thank you. But if that's what your film is, but then your film doesn't really do anything more than just riff on those, then what's the point?
Well, I think the point has to be not to educate or tell us what Bob Dylan's life was, but to reflect on it, to have a poetic reaction to it.
Is
my guess. Not to put words in Haynes' mouth, but...
Yeah. I wonder if it does that, though. And it didn't do that for me. And I would be sort of target audience number one, I would think.
Yeah. Well, I think some parts work better than others, like the part with the little kid who hops the trains and plays folk music. Some of that, and not that I'm an expert in acting or that I care that much about it, but some of the acting was distracting enough, as in not that good, that I felt like, wow, this is, you know, I'm not sure why this good movie with good actors also has a lot of bad actors in it. And it's like, I'm not getting a lot out of this. And yet, other times, like these sequences with Cate Blanchett as Bob Dylan and David Cross as Allen Ginsberg, as they're sort of romping around, it made me laugh. I thought that was very funny. And even that's inspired casting. As soon as I saw David Cross dressed up as Allen Ginsberg, I thought, that's perfect.
Yes, but see, I think so many of the pleasures of the movie are almost outside of the film. You know, it's like, ha ha ha, there's David Cross.
Yeah.
Or I noticed in the screening where I was at, you know, a lot of people just seem to enjoy being able to place the reference, almost like if they were watching a Simpsons episode, where it's like, oh, ha, I see which movie that is. Here it's, oh, ha ha, I know what famous photo that is, or I know what album cover that is. And even though in the movie he's changed all the names and he's changed, you know, the names of the albums themselves, but yet still stayed with for all intents and purposes, the same album cover.
Yeah, no, if he's doing nothing more than congratulating the audience for their arcane knowledge, then he's Quentin Tarantino and his pop culture references, you know. So maybe you're right.
But the thing is, it's not that I dislike the film, but I find it frustrating in that, because I'm not sure I can get past that. You know, and one of the other things about Haynes that I was reminded of in this movie is that he seems more interested in recreating picture-perfect recreations of things. And so, you know...
The press conference, for example, that we saw in the Martin Scorsese documentary. Yeah.
Right. Or just the sets. You know, so you have these houses that are like picture-perfect replicas of what a house would have looked like in 1967 or 1972. You know, down to, you know, what kind of carpeting they had on the floor and what kind of, you know, alarm clocks or phones they had. You know, and it reminds me, I liked Far From Heaven quite a bit.
Yeah.
But I remember one of the criticisms of that film was it seemed more interested in recreating, you know, a 50s melodrama than actually doing something with it. And I sometimes feel that way about this film, is that it's more interested in kind of just recreating down to the, you know, a simulacrum of something that never existed.
In the case of Far From Heaven, I think that was, he's also recreating Douglas Sirk. And so Douglas Sirk was very interested in the sets. Therefore, he needs to be if he's going to make a modern Sirk movie.
Yep.
This I'm Not There is the kind of movie that, at least for me and other people I've talked to, invites a lot of what he should have done is, or what I wish he had done, or was he doing this. I would prefer to just react to the movie as it is, and that's what I'm trying to do as I think about the movie, and yet I for some reason don't have anything to grab onto.
Right. Yeah. And yes, exactly. There's things about the movie that I like, but I am left with almost an emptiness about it. That then makes me want to think about, oh, this is a postmodern film, or oh, this is this kind of movie, or, you know, rather than dealing with the movie on its own terms, because I'm not quite sure what those terms are.
Yeah.
there is this idea out there that abstract art and modern art in general is one kind of racket, is a put-on. And that if a child can do it, it sort of pulls the veil off this con game.
All I really want for Marla is to be a happy, well-adjusted kid.
People are asking about this art for real. They want to know who did it, and they want to know how much it cost.
I told this to the parents the first time that I saw her work. You're in for a wild ride. I hope you're prepared for this.
We begin tonight with something of a mystery.
Even if a 3 or 4-year-old didn't do them, you'd like them. The fact that she is 4 makes it really incredible.
So what do we have here?
You have a genius.
Yeah.
The New York Times picked up the story, and it was like somebody had ignited a fuse.
10 of her abstract paintings sold for thousands of dollars.
Some big bucks as well.
Oprah just called. The owner of the Houston Rockets just bought one. It's probably the most popular story in the world right now.
This is eye-opening to me to see her actually painting, because she's not doing anything that a normal child wouldn't do.
Is 4-year-old painter Marla Olmsted a prodigy?
Some question the authenticity of the artwork.
Marla has been the sole creator of her work.
No one has touched any paint to her canvases.
Everybody's trying to shape the story into something that they want it to be.
What have I done to my children, putting them through this?
I think that she definitely has a gift, something that's very advanced.
Is there any other explanation?
I'm sure they must feel a little nervous now about you.
You don't want to talk at all about your new paintings?
No.
I choose to trust you.
I don't think anybody really knows what you're going to do with the story.
Where are you going with it now?
I want footage of Marla painting. That'll put my doubts to rest.
My reputation's on the line here as well.
Turn off the camera.
The whole story really is about grown-ups. She's just a little girl painting in her house.
That was the trailer for a new documentary called My Kid Could Paint That, about a 4-year-old girl who paints these abstract paintings that have sold for thousands or tens of thousands of dollars and been featured in the New York Times and on 60 Minutes. Now, this discussion features what I would consider minor to moderate spoilers. So if you're interested in seeing this movie and don't want some of those things spoiled for you, you may want to skip this and come back to it after you've seen the movie. But in order to talk about this movie in any depth, we wanted to talk about some of the things that are revealed around the midpoint of this pretty short documentary. J. Robert, what'd you think?
I like this movie a lot. I think it's really provocative. I went in with somewhat low expectations, and so I think maybe that helps, just because I sort of thought that this was going to be maybe a cutesy documentary. I'm not sure why I thought that, but that was kind of the impression I had going in. But it's a movie that I think is pretty sophisticated. It's because it's a movie that starts off being about art, and what does it mean that a 4-year-old can paint abstract paintings that are worth $25,000. What does that say about the art market? What does that say about abstract art? What does it say about people who need a story behind their art? And I think the movie does a nice job, particularly in the first half of it, of exploring those ideas. But then I think about the midway part of the film, which feels like maybe the midway point of when he was filming the movie. There's this 60 Minutes piece that comes out, which basically tries to debunk this little girl and basically say that this little girl was probably not painting these paintings, that her dad was much more the artist involved, and that, you know, whatever you think of the paintings, it's probably not the little girl's genius that's behind it. And so then the last half of the film becomes about that and about, you know, what the family goes through and what's clearly a traumatic traumatic situation for them as they try to defend themselves and try to say, no, it wasn't the father, it's always been the little girl. But then, and this is what's my favorite part of the movie, is that it becomes also about the director and his relationship with this family and whether he believes the family. And his own sort of conflicted emotions about that, because he's become friendly with them. At the same time, he's trying to make a movie that he can sell, you know, and it's a much sexier kind of movie if there's actually some sort of conflict about it. And how does he feel about that? And so for me, the fact that it deals with all of these issues, I found really interesting.
Yeah, I felt like it raises a bewildering number of questions. Effortlessly, And yep. I mean, in that first 45 minutes or hour, I think it's like 45 minutes because it's a fairly short movie. I think it's 80 some minutes. Mm-hmm. That first half, I mean, I felt like I had so much to think about. I mean, all these synapses were firing one after the other, all these mm-hmm. things that are raised. It doesn't seem like it's that dense, but it is a very nope. dense, compact movie yep. That's raising all these questions about what is art and what is, frankly, should parents be doing this? I mean, even yeah. if you can make tens of thousands of dollars from your kids' painting, do you really want to parade them around? And the parents are wondering those same questions. They're not evil people. They're asking themselves this, and there are so many. It's like a little mystery, but it's like 11 mysteries layered on top of mm-hmm. each other. And then there's that, the turn, the 60 minutes thing that is a surprise and that sort of brings everything to a halt in some ways. And so up to that point, I think this is one of the best movies of the year. I did not like so much the parts where he inserts himself. And here's the reason for that. This movie has a point of view before he speaks to his own camera. This film gives us little snippets of dialogue, and we get to see little things that almost like an Agatha Christie mystery we don't know the significance of until later. And then we think back on that and think, wow, that was interesting. And just the way he assembles this, it's a very, I feel like, very strong but subtle point of view that he has. And then he feels a need to sort of bring this to the fore and talk to the family. And I felt like this was more more manipulative of us, the audience, than it seems. I think that I think what he's done is he set up the situation where he needs access to this family to finish his movie and have something to sell. And yep. in order to do that, he needs to be on their side. I mean, they let him into their house because they're naive. They never suspected that 60 Minutes was going to come down on them like this. And now they might never have asked him to come in, but he's already in. He needs to stay in. And one way he can do that is by his honesty, I think, and by coming forward, and he earns points with us by confronting them. And yet that confrontation where he just wants to ask them if anyone helped the little girl with her paintings and they'll say yes or no is much simpler than the more subtle critiques that have been throughout the movie, where he's monitoring their unguarded moments. And I think he recovers from that. I feel like this doesn't, I still like the movie a lot. I just feel like it's that point where for me it dips, and I think for a lot of other people it's the opposite. I think he recovers from that because later the family documents one of her paintings and they're touting this, and his critique of that movie is solely, or his critique of that move, of that painting is solely visual. You know, he shows that painting for a while awesome. And then he has this montage where he shows other paintings. He says nothing, but we know, we can see what we're seeing, you know. He leaves a certain amount of it open, but I believe it's clear what he's saying too.
Absolutely. And also then after we've seen that montage of the paintings, there's that really incredible sequence where the family's friend, who's an art dealer, is trying to sell that particular painting that they are highlighting to this older couple who have the same perspective as we do, yeah. but are being sort of given this hard sell of why they shouldn't have that perspective on the painting.
And I think they also don't recognize that perspective is controversial, and therefore they voice yep. it openly without right. realizing that we're going, yeah, yep. that's true, that's right.
Yep. Yeah. No, it's I completely understand that. For me, what I thought was interesting about that confrontation with a family that you don't like is I'll admit that it's not as subtle as the rest of the film, but I think that lack of subtlety is important for probably the large proportion of the people who will see this movie. You and I think probably much more than most people do about the position of documentary filmmakers and the tenuous position it is, you know, the ethical responsibilities of a documentary filmmaker to his audience, to his subjects, to his art. Whereas I suspect that most people who come to this movie don't think about those issues very much. And so the fact that the movie has to raise them explicitly, I don't have a problem with. But the fact that the movie does raise them, I think, is really useful and just adds to the large thematic concerns that the movie has, and I think deals with it in a really interesting way. And so I I actually appreciated that sequence, not because I necessarily needed it, but I think it's really useful for an audience that doesn't think about those issues as much.
I think you're right that that's exactly why I did it. And I guess I often crave documentaries that don't tell me what they're doing and tell me what to think and let me do it on my own. And that isn't to say that I want a documentary with no point of view, not that at all. I just don't think it needs to tell me everything because there are other ways to tell me things. One time I saw a documentary on Edward Muybridge by Tom Anderson. It's a really great and interesting documentary about this guy who, in before cinema, he made these photos. They're like photos of people and animals in motion. And the rumor was that he started doing this because Leland Stanford, the mogul, wanted to settle a bet about whether a horse's hooves were ever completely off the ground, all four of them, whenever he was in a full trot. And so, you know, Edward Muybridge with his technology sets up these things and he can capture, you know, rapid photos, you know, 20 of them in a row, and we can see for sure once and for all. And it sort of started this career of Muybridge's that he made all kinds of these sequences of animals and things, and they're famous. You've probably seen them without realizing it. Well, I saw this screening. It's a great documentary, very interesting. And afterward, at this screening, Tom Anderson was there, the director was there, and he was answering questions. And someone asked, I saw this documentary, and I've heard this about the bet about the horse's hooves. Are they all four off the ground? And Anderson's answer I loved. He was like, I think you saw the film. And he didn't answer that because, yes, we all saw. I mean, we all saw. It's yes, they are all off the ground. But I love that he's a very, he's a kind of a cantankerous guy if you've ever seen him. But he was like, I didn't say it in my documentary. I'm not going to say it in front of you. You can see with your own eyes that those hooves are off the ground. And I crave documentaries like that because they're so rare. I mean, in this age of reality TV, documentaries are thriving on TV and everywhere. And yet they're very seldom of the variety where you have to sort of read between the lines yourself. And I often like that. And in some ways, that's not a criticism of My Kid Could Paint That because it offers plenty of that to me. But it also, I think, has this surface level that is less interesting to me.
And I can appreciate that. I guess for me, I am craving documentaries that force people to think about what's going on in a documentary, because they're sucked in by reality TV and they don't realize how unbelievably manipulative that is at every step of the way. And so a documentary that can acknowledge at least some of that, I think is worth savoring. So for me, that's just kind of my what I'm particularly interested in right now.
Well, I saw this little girl's disputed painting, Ocean, hanging at a gallery in Park City, Utah. And I can tell you that, I don't know. I just don't know.
It's I don't want to sort of prejudice people before they see it, because I think the film is well worth seeing, whether you have a chance to
definitely
see it in a theater, because I know it's playing it in around theaters right now, or if you see it on DVD in a few months. But I think the movie has a very particular point of view, as you said, but a particular point of view on that topic. Although not everyone agrees with me on that, so
I do.
The Red Balloon from 1956 by Albert Lamaurice.
How different was it for you watching it on the big screen as opposed to the internet?
It's beautiful on a big screen. It's a very gray brown movie, except for this splash of red. But it sort of tunes your eyes to that red, and so anytime you see it somewhere else, like a stoplight or a sign in a window, you're instantly drawn to it. And I think Ho Sho Shin actually did that a little bit in his movie. We don't have to go into the similarities with that movie just yet, but. It's a really great movie to see on the big screen.
Yeah. And in particularly not just the fact that it's, you've got this red standing out from the brown and gray, but then at the end when you have the whole parade of balloons, I mean, it's just a brilliant use of color and light. It's really joyful, I think, and because of the contrast of the colors.
Now, the first question I have with a movie like The Red Balloon is, of course, about anthropomorphism. you know, does this balloon take action, have preferences? It seems to. But you see, that's unrealistic because we know that from Don Hertzfeldt's animated short, Billy's Balloon. Have you seen that? We know that if a balloon could take action and have preferences, it would be to, you know, to beat the kids that are holding it and to strangle them, to drag them high into the air and drop them on their heads. And so this is clearly unrealistic.
But you do have a couple moments where the balloon actually taunts people, you know, particularly he taunts the old man, which I thought it was really funny. It made me laugh when I was watching it.
Yeah. No, I think this is obviously a child's fantasy. And I think that I would love to show this to some kid today. You know, it's made in 1957 or something. And yet I think that it's one of those sort of fantastical ideas that you have this friend. It's almost a melancholy idea that this kid's a little bit of an outsider, but he has this one friend, and it's the greatest friend because it's a balloon. You know, it's sort of mystifying to everyone and amazing to everyone, and it knows what floor he's going to stop on, and it knows, you know, waits around for him afterward, and so it's definitely something that I think would be captivating to somebody who was 5 or 6 or 7 or 8. You know.
Yep. Yeah, I think that's right. I just think it's a really lovely movie. It's, you know, I'm always impressed by movies that don't need to really have any dialogue. And there's a few lines of dialogue in that film, but it's mostly silent and or it's dialogue free, I should say. And yet it tells this really beautiful, rich story. And I thought the ending was pretty much transcendent. I was blown away by that.
White Mane from 1953, also by Albert Lamorisse.
Did you see the White Mane?
I did, which I was struck by what a similar storyline it was. You know, substitute horse for balloon, and it, or at least the themes are similar, and the interaction of the boy and the horse is very similar. So that has some of the coolest tracking shots I think I've ever seen. Just the shots of these horses running, you know, through this low marsh is really unbelievable. So what did you think of it?
I didn't like it as well as the red balloon.
I agree.
It's way too long to show, I think, a kid nowadays anyway. But it's also something about the idea of befriending a balloon is cool, but befriending a horse is not. Because horses are real and you can't really befriend them. They don't really act like that. And also you got the evil guys who are going to try and, you know, grab the horse. And I don't know. It seemed to... I didn't love it as well as I didn't like as much as the red balloon.
I didn't like it as much, although I think it's I could just appreciate it for its surface pleasures. You know, the black and white cinematography is pretty spectacular, and so you know, there's certain scenes where the boy and the horse are standing in this almost reflecting pool, and so you see them reflected in the water, and I really like those shots a lot. It's a bit heavy-handed, maybe.
It's kind of a marshy area of France that I don't think I've ever seen in real life or in movies before. Yeah. So that's kind of interesting.
It was interesting. So actually, there were several kids at the screening I went to, and I think they seemed a little bit more interested in White Mane than they did in the Red Balloon.
Oh, really?
Yep.
Of course, it came first, right?
Red Balloon comes first.
Oh, really? Oh, it was flipped here.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. No, we had Red Balloon first. And it's we're talking about a real small sample size here. It's just the kids who happen to be around me. But I think for them, the story of the horse, just they can relate more to a horse than they can to a balloon. It was, I think, a little bit less abstract for them.
Yeah.
I think the parade of balloons at the end, they couldn't quite understand why that was so really fantastic. whereas the thought of the boy and the horse running, they could understand why that had appeal.
Okay. So. Yeah, maybe my thought experiment is wrong then. I'll try it one day. If movies are still around in a few years.
Yeah. Well, and again, it might all these kids were all 6, 7, 8. It was really cool. A lot of parents brought their kids to that double feature. I was really excited about that. But you know, maybe the red balloon will work for, you know, 10, 11 year olds as opposed to 6, 7 year olds.
Maybe that's it. Yeah. I do think that the kid with the red balloon is going to grow up, change his name to Lars, move to the US and demand that people accept his inflatable girlfriend.
Oh, it's too funny. The boy does actually sort of give off that vibe. It's kind of strange.
He's just getting all the wrong reinforcement. Is all I think. Yeah.
I don't know if you had this experience, Rob, as you were watching The Red Balloon, but I kept thinking, boy, they couldn't make that movie today. They wouldn't let six-year-old boys sort of do all these stunts by themselves. You
know, he's like, climbing up lampposts. And
I mean, it's like, whoa, where's the net? Where's the stunt guy? It's funny how different things were 50 years ago.
Lions for Lambs.
Have you seen Lions for Lambs?
I have not.
The Robert Redford film about the war. Boy, it's an odd one. It's really strange. You know, it's sort of...
It stars Tom Cruise, right?
Tom Cruise, Meryl Streep, and Robert Redford himself, and he directed it. Well, early on, shortly after the Iraq War started, you know, we had these great documentaries about the war, Iraq in Fragments and the war tapes, and quite a few, actually. And now we're getting to the fiction films. You know, they take longer to make, and I think also it's harder to justify spending money on them until people start disliking the war, and you think maybe they'll accept something like this. But what I would want from that is something that has been more considered. I mean, if you're making movies in the moment, it's enough to just bring us pictures from that world, you know, show us what's going on, give us a little bit of reflection. I'm surprised actually that James Longley, who did Iraq in Fragments, was so thoughtful about the whole thing and gave us so much to think about. But I really expect that from these fiction films who've had several years to think about this, you know? And I'm not really sure what to make of Robert Redford's attempt at that, Lions for Lambs. It's sort of a weird splicing of ideas. One is he's a political science professor who's trying to encourage one of his star students, but a student who's also becoming disinterested in politics because he's sort of disillusioned by the whole thing. He's trying to get him interested and get him to do something, get him fired up. At the same time, we have Meryl Streep playing a reporter talking to Tom Cruise, a senator. Frank T.J. Mackey is now a senator. And he's got a scoop for her about a new thing they're doing in Afghanistan. He's feeding it to her and she's supposed to eat it up and print it, but now she's a little more skeptical of this sort of thing and she feels maybe, you know, culpable for what's happened. And then there's this third part where we actually see some folks in Afghanistan who are sort of tied to both of these other stories, these soldiers, American soldiers. So it's these three sort of weird pieces. But it feels to me like, gosh, I wish we could inspire young people to do something. And I wish that journalists felt responsible for what has happened. But this is just a dramatization of that wish. It isn't creating that. You know, this isn't doing anything to inspire anyone or to explore the idea of journalism and how it's what its responsibilities are in relation to, you know, the political leaders. So I didn't take anything away from it. You know, I suppose if you'd never thought about any of those ideas before, you might think, wow, that's true. The journalist should bear some responsibility. Kids really should get interested. That's not very much to take away after all these years of thinking about this and putting something together. And I expect something a little bit more.
That's too bad.
Yeah.
Rendition.
But you actually liked, or you thought Rendition had some value.
Yeah. I don't think I've seen a fiction film about these themes yet that really explores them as deeply and as I'd like. But Rendition is much better than I expected.
Just for people, what that film stars Reese Witherspoon,
mm-hmm. and Jake Gyllenhaal.
Yep.
And it's not so much about Iraq, but it's about this practice of rendition, where you have somebody who's connected to terrorists, and you want to get information out of them. We're limited in what we can do here in the U.S. We can't torture people, therefore send him to Egypt, let's say, where they can. It's almost like, you know, a technicality. And the CIA guy will stand by while someone there does the torturing and asks the questions that we've asked them to ask. You know, it's this very distasteful, stupid practice that is maybe following the letter of the law, but certainly not the spirit.
Yeah.
And this is, I think this movie, it's not a perfect movie, but it does a very good job of just showing that this happens, and also showing it in a fairly complex light. I don't think that it made me necessarily think about it any more deeply, but with things like torture, part of the way that this has happened that this is going on in our world and on our watch and by our government is that it's so distant and invisible to us that we let it.
Yeah.
Therefore, I think dramatization of something like that actually is valuable, unlike dramatization of a professor inspiring his students. Yeah. That doesn't do anything for me.
Yeah.
But this actually, you know, look, we see it happen. And this, we see the guy who they're doing it to, and you learn about him. It's not, he's not some faceless, nameless person, you know, who's being tortured. So it's, I think that these are very interesting things to think about. And I think that that movie is worth someone's time.
Okay. Oh, good. Because the reviews of that were pretty mediocre. And so I had kind of written it off. So that's interesting to think that there's more to it than that.
Well, it's unfortunate that what I've seen in newspapers and in headlines, well, these movies about Iraq, they're bombing. Nobody wants to hear about that stuff.
Yeah.
Well, that may be true, but it's unfortunate that that's the story. The box office draw is the story and not the subject at hand. Now, maybe that's the filmmaker's fault. Make a better movie. Make a movie people do want to see. But at the same time, you can't use box office receipts to gauge anything because there are so many other factors, so many variables involved.
Yeah.
So it's unfortunate that that is the discussion, though, to me.
No, well, because what it is, I mean, and we see this in almost every aspect of society today. I mean, you know, it's not who has the better arguments. It's who, quote unquote, won the debate or who's ahead in the polls or who's gaining in the polls or, you know, who had the best zinger of the night. You know, it's all these sort of irrelevant ideas that, you know, newspapers actually think are newsworthy. And it's not, you know, what's going on. That's been true for movies, of course, for the last 20 years, ever since, you know, it wasn't what was the best reviewed movie of the week, but who was number one at the box offices. If that somehow is a proper way of judging a film's worth. You know, I mean, yeah, it's, sure, that's interesting to the producers of the film and the studios, and they can care about that. But why would I possibly care about that?
Yeah.
It just doesn't make any sense to me. And yet, because we've had it beaten into our heads for so many years, we've come to think that too.
Have you ever observed a correlation between how much a movie costs and how much you enjoyed it, or how much it brought in and how much you enjoyed it?
Yeah, that's right. I mean, it's just ridiculous.
Juno.
What'd you think of Juno?
Oh, you know, I like Juno a lot. It's not a perfect film by any means, and not to pick on your publication, but it's not the number one movie of the year either. But
I agree with that.
I like it for two reasons, and those two reasons are Ellen Page and Michael Cera, who play Ellen Page plays the teenage pregnant mother. In a hilarious scene that opens the movie, takes several different pregnancy tests and realizes that she's pregnant, and then Michael Cera is the father of the child and isn't necessarily sad or excited about that. He's kind of, you know, nervous that his mom's going to find out. But I love these two characters. I love their relationship. Someone complained that Michael Cera was just playing the same role he played in Arrested Development.
Yeah, he was George Michael in Arrested Development. Yeah.
And my response was, yeah, and I love that character. And if he plays that character for the next 10 years, that'd be okay by me. You know, that'll be just fine. And so anytime those two are on screen together, I think it's just awesome. And that carries it for me. There are other parts of the film that I'm not as excited about, but it's really sweet. It's genuinely funny. It's smart, and Ellen Page is fantastic. What do you think?
Yeah, I agree with all that. It's really cute, and this is a year of strong, heartfelt comedies. I mean, lots of them, and these are really good. They're good movies, and they're funny, and anybody can enjoy them. It's also weird that there have been three that I count movies about unwanted pregnancies that fall into the same category. There's this one plus Waitress and Knocked Up. They all take a little bit different tack, I think. And I thought Juno was really cute. I wouldn't put it anywhere number one on my own personal list either. but I agree that these characters are just really fun to watch. And it's fun to see them try to figure out who they are, you know, which is very much a part of any 16-year-old's life. But even this girl who seems so sort of to have her identity figured out doesn't. It's, you know, it's for show, sort of, you know, as it is for anyone.
Yep.
I thought it was a fun movie. You know, of these three, I think I probably prefer Waitress. I liked them all, but I think that Waitress is the clunkiest. It's not as polished as these other two, and yet it's, it has this feminist streak, and it's a little bit unpredictable, and I don't know where it's, what it's going to do. And the others, I think I'm fairly sure where it's going to go, you know. And
yeah.
So,
I agree with that. I think I like Juno the best of the three, although I completely agree with your assessment of Waitress. And actually, one of my problems with Juno is it feels a little bit too polished, particularly in the way it just drops every single pop culture reference it can. Mm-hmm. You know, that just felt a little too smart for its own good. But there were other things I liked about it that sort of, you know, gave it the edge, I guess.
And every one of her references is well beyond her age. And I think
Yeah. And no matter how smart she is, it's like, did she sit up all night just planning these Bond mods?
Exactly.
So I got a little bit tired of that, to be quite honest. Although there is, this is a completely different thing, but my favorite moment in the movie is, and I'm gonna try not to spoil anything here, but right near the end, Ellen Page is talking about how Michael Cera's character is really cool and without even trying, and Michael Cera's character says, "I try really hard." Yeah. It just kills me. I just laughed and laughed and laughed. It's one of my favorite lines of the entire year.
Yeah.
There will be blood.
Now, I just saw the new P.T. Anderson flick, There Will Be Blood.
I will see you tomorrow morning.
Oh,
so.
Really?
No spoilers your way, sir.
Well, I don't know. I'm curious to hear what you think of P.T. Anderson. I suppose he has my begrudging respect.
Oh, okay.
Because,
I like him more than...
Well, I liked Sydney, or sometimes called Hard Eight, his first movie. Boogie Nights I also liked. I think it's so reminiscent of Raging Bull and Goodfellas that it's sort of uncomfortably so, you know? I don't think he had found himself. Magnolia, I loved, and yet I recognize that it is so flawed, it's just nuts. And I don't mean because, I won't spoil it. Not for the obvious reasons. I just think it's, you know, it's a crazy thing he was trying to do. But he tried to do it, and that was kind of cool. Punch Drunk Love I didn't care much for, and haven't seen it a second time.
Let me just interrupt for a second. Mm-hmm. I would agree with everything you just said, except that I would raise each one of those up a notch. So, in other words, your general order of things is correct, I think. But I would be a little more enthusiastic about each of those. But now There Will Be Blood.
Well, he's clearly talented, and he's solidly in my, you know, just see it when he releases a new movie category, you know, because he's interesting and he's young enough that I'm curious about what he's going to do the rest of his career. And this is not like anything he's done before. It's almost like Citizen Kane or something. It's a portrait of this one guy, driven, complex character played by Daniel Day-Lewis, who I think is just one of the best actors there is. The only thing I care to remember about Gangs of New York is the way he would tap his glass eye with the point of his knife. Yeah. Man, he's great. And he just disappears into a character to a scary degree, and he is intense. And this movie is based on a book called Oil by Upton Sinclair, which I've not read, but I'm actually kind of curious to read. It's about the early 1903 to 1927 in this guy's life. He's a self-made man who he's an oil man. He digs for oil and finds it, and he's good at it. And so people hire him to do that. And yet that's a very complicated business. There were a lot of corners that were cut and shenanigans that were had. I found his performance so riveting that I really enjoyed the movie, even though it's very long, and I'm not completely sure what it tells me about our world, but I certainly liked the world in the movie and liked following to see where it was going to go.
Well, good, good, good.
Youth Without Youth.
I saw the Francis Ford Coppola's new movie, Youth Without Youth.
Yeah.
Which I think probably also bears longer discussion at some point when you've had a chance to see it. I was telling someone a couple days ago, and then someone else agreed with me this morning, that it feels a little bit like Southland Tales, the Richard Kelly film. Not thematically, but tonally, in that it's Coppola just taking lots and lots of chances and doing lots of crazy things. The movie, I won't even try to describe the plot because it's really difficult, but it's basically Tim Roth plays this man who's on the verge of committing suicide right at the beginning of the movie, who gets hit by lightning. and suddenly becomes a much younger man. Once he's recovered from the burns, he's gone from being a man of 70 to a man of about 40. And then it doesn't really appear that he ages anymore. And it's about what he does as a younger man and what that's like, and whether he can try to fulfill his life's passion. It's very much an old man's movie, in that it's obsessed with ideas of aging, and of, you know, what happens if you haven't done what you really wanted to in life, and is it possible to fulfill your life's quote unquote purpose? And it's exciting to see Coppola taking chances, and it's a really, you know, it's a beautiful movie. Did you see the re-release of One from the Heart a few years back?
I missed it. No.
Oh, that's that movie is deeply flawed, but it's pretty spectacular in places. And this reminded me in the same way. I'm not sure I can recommend Youth Without Youth. When you take a lot of chances, some of them don't work. And particularly, I think the ending doesn't work. But it was kind of exciting to watch anyway. I was kind of, even if I didn't much always like it, I was kind of enchanted by it in a weird sort of way.
You know, I have so wanted Coppola to make another good movie. And a lot of these guys from this generation, I think, have so much invested in who they are or were that they can't throw caution to the winds and do something. Like, I would love for Scorsese to just, as my wife said, he should have to make a low budget movie with no stars and only diegetic music. I thought that's an excellent recipe for a Scorsese movie, and I wish he would do it, but he never will. But to hear of, I don't even know what this movie's about other than what you've just said, but I did hear that he was wanting to just get back to his roots and, you know, get behind the camera and just do it. And I really loved to hear that. I mean, this is a guy who made The Godfather, The Conversation, Godfather Part Two, Apocalypse Now, back to back.
Yeah, in one decade.
Yeah.
I mean, unless you want to talk about Godard in the 60s, I can't think of another filmmaker who had just such an amazing, spectacular decade. I can't.
Well, I know the conventional wisdom is that Apocalypse Now destroyed him, you know, that he lost himself in the jungle. He overdid it. Right. But, I mean, Bram Stoker's Dracula is not a great movie, but there are so many beautiful and weird things in that movie that I thought he's still got a spark, you know? I would really like to see him do something great. So I'm certainly curious about this movie.
Yeah, and I think it'll have a lot of fans and a lot of detractors too. It's a film that throws a lot up on the wall to see what sticks.
Redacted.
I saw Redacted, the Brian De Palma movie. But maybe we've talked. Maybe I'm tired of talking about the Iraq movies. Should I talk about the Iraq? Should I talk about that?
Real quick. This one's worth seeing, not worth seeing?
This is the one that I'm probably most conflicted about because on certain sort of aesthetic levels, it's, I don't think it's very interesting at all. It's sort of shot as if it were, or assembled as if it were a documentary. And we had footage of these guys in Iraq because they videotaped themselves where there are security cameras and stuff. It's almost like, I wish we had footage of this event and we could assemble a documentary like this and it would really be damning. Mm. We don't. The acting is really poor in some ways, or at least it distracted me. And yet it's kind of refreshing to see this movie is just really angry. I mean, this guy is not going to make any friends with this movie. He's unlike, say, Redford, who is trying to be reasonable and balanced and not alienate people who are perhaps conservative or who supported the war, but are unhappy with how it's going and might agree with many of his points. Brian De Palma's not doing that. He is documenting this one horrible event.
Yep.
And sees it as a symbol of the entire thing. Yep. And there are some really fascinating things in the movie. And that anger is interesting. I'm not sure that it's productive. And I think, I'm not sure what to think.
Mm.
Margot at the Wedding.
Speaking of anger, I saw Margot at the Wedding last week, which I think you like a little bit more than I do. But I thought it was fine. I think the acting's fantastic. I'm a big Nicole Kidman fan, and so watching, you know, and Jennifer Jason Leigh, and so seeing them work, and it's, for those people not familiar, it's directed by Noah Baumbach, who did Squid and the Whale, and it feels of a piece with that movie, where we've got dysfunctional family, sort of with director stand-in as a teenage boy in the middle of it all. And Nicole Kidman's gone back to the Hamptons for Jennifer Jason Leigh's wedding to Jack Black, who in a rare break from his stereotype is playing a failed rocker. Although Jack Black, I think, is quite good. But the movie is really kind of ugly in the sense that none of these characters are in any way attractive, and they're all hideous to each other and hideous to themselves in lots of ways. And so as much as I could admire the acting, I just found myself not really caring after a while. And so when the ending comes and we're supposed to have this kind of breakthrough or sort of a breakthrough, I didn't think it was anything to remember as I left. So
I did like it more than you. I don't think it's something I'm going to think a lot about down the road, yeah. But I do think that what you said about the acting is great, but I never really am drawn to that. As long as the acting, I think, leaves me in the world. Here I just praise Daniel Day-Lewis's performance, but I think it's because it's so, I felt like I was there with this guy, you know, but all of these folks are really interesting to watch. I think that Nicole Kidman's character, Margot, does seem ugly, and yet I think that it's a defense mechanism, you know, about how she feels about herself, and I think that comes out later. At first, it seems like it's simply condescension. She's a sophisticated urbanite, and she looks down on this rural world where she is at the moment and her sister. And yet I think that the sort of lashing out that she does, after a while, we begin to see what's beneath it. And I think that that is interesting. And I didn't dislike these characters the way I've heard a lot of people who agree with you on this, that they're just not likable people. Mm-hmm. They certainly are flawed, but I enjoyed watching them try to share a house for a few days. Maybe that's all.
Would you have wanted to be in that house?
I wouldn't have wanted to be in that house, no. So yeah, there's a certain dread, and yet it's not an unfamiliar dread. I mean, my family is not like that, but you know how whenever you're sort of with family for holidays or whatever, you're all sort of together in confined quarters for a long time, and yeah. There are tensions, and so it's not completely unfamiliar.
Yeah, I guess that's right.
Before the Devil Knows You're Dead.
This is a movie in which yet another unbelievable performance from Philip Seymour Hoffman, who's just, you know, maybe next to Daniel Day-Lewis, one of the great actors of our generation. But he and Ethan Hawke play brothers. You have to sort of get past that. Unbelievability scale, I'm not sure that rate's very high. But both of them are in sort of difficult straits. And they decide, really Philip Seymour Hoffman sort of decides and convinces his brother to join him, that they're going to rob a jewelry store. And as you see in a really spectacular set piece early in the film, the robbery goes bad. And then the rest of the movie is about the recriminations that and the difficulties that come away from that. As first, their father, Albert Finney, who's played by Albert Finney, doesn't understand what's happened. But then as time goes on, he becomes more and more sensing that maybe his sons have something to do with this. And so the movie is actually really interesting. Are Philip Seymour Hoffman and Ethan Hawke going to be able to get out of this mess that they've created for themselves? And so I was kind of grooving on that for a while, both as an exercise in narrative, as also an exercise in acting. But then towards the end, it just completely goes off the rails, and the ending is it's a doozy. Although the thing about this ending is, as crazy as it is, you can really see it coming about a half hour before. And so I got really bored at the end because I just sort of knew what was going to happen, and I was just kind of waiting for it to happen. So it's not a bad film, but it's a somewhat disappointing film because I was kind of liking it for a while.
Now, this is Sidney Lumet directed it?
Yes, that's right. That's right.
Any echoes with Dog Day Afternoon, which he directed, which is also about a robbery?
That's a good question. Dog Day Afternoon is a much better movie.
And with that, we'll wrap up this edition of the Errata Movie Podcast. Sorry to cram so much into one episode. We'll be back to more normal-sized episodes shortly. But first, next time, we're going to talk about our favorites of 2007. Someone told us we really need to do that before the end of 2008.
Seems like good advice. So we'll do that right away. And then we'll get back to normal stuff. For more information about the movies that we talked about today and further reading, please visit www.erratamag.com/podcast. That's erratamag.com. There you can leave us a comment, or you can send us email, feedback@erratamag.com, or leave us a voicemail at 415-287-4020. No one will answer. Talk to nobody, but we'll get your message. See you next time.